Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. For those of you whom I haven't had the pleasure of meeting, I'm Paul LeClair, and it's my great privilege to be the president of the greatest library in the world, the New York Public Library, and to welcome you all this evening to the Celeste Bartos Forum for what is bound to be a totally unforgettable evening. If you need any reminder of how important this library is to people and to New York and to America, I urge you to get a copy of today's Daily News and look at the editorial page. And I'm just going to take a minute to read the editorial that I think says everything that needs to be said about the importance of the library. The headline is, "I got my job through ... the New York Public Library." That might well be the slogan of an ad campaign suited to an era when unemployment is rising and the U.S. is shedding hundreds of thousands of jobs a month. As a reminder that local libraries offer extensive jobs research opportunities, here's how Barack Obama found his community organizing job in Chicago after he graduated from Columbia University. In 2005, he had told American Libraries magazine, and I quote, "People always mention libraries in terms of just being sources for reading materials or research, but I probably would not be in Chicago were it not for the Mid-Manhattan Public Library, because I was looking for an organizing job and was having great trouble finding a job as a community organizer in New York." Continue the quotation. "The Mid-Manhattan Library had these books of lists of organizations, and the librarian helped me find these lists of organizations, and I wrote to every organization. One of them wound up hiring me. One of them wound up being an organization in Chicago that I got a job with," end of quote. The help is still there, and it is even of greater sophistication. Check it out. So the New York Public Library had a role in the life of the president-elect. And each month we have approximately 1.25 million visits to the 91 libraries that make up the system. And who knows what great things are going to become of the people that come to us on a daily basis. Now, I would like all of you, if you're not already involved in the life of the library, to do so. It will cost you very little as $40. Become a friend. If you care about what this library means to you in terms of your own intellectual and cultural life, if you care what it means to the people of New York, if you care what it means to the Barack Obamas who are children today, do this. Do it. Pick up a folder as you go out. Become our friend. We need you now. We really do. Now, for the business of tonight's program. As you know, the topic of tonight's sort of symposium here is what happens now, featuring the distinguished writers Andrew Del Banco, Joan Didion, Jeff Madrick, Daryl Pinkney, Michael Tomasky, and Gary Wills, moderated by the one and only Robert Silvers. As you may have guessed, tonight's program is a collaboration between the Dorothy and Lewis B. Cullman Center for Scholars and Writers here at the library and our Live from New York Public Library program and another one of New York's treasured resources, the New York Review of Books. This is also part of the celebration of the review's 45th anniversary, and it is also a moment for us to extend our deep gratitude to Bob Silvers and the others who brought the New York Review of Books into being. Gratitude is something that's been commented on by writers over the ages, and a few of the things that various writers have said about gratitude are the following, beginning with the ancients. The ancients sort of got it right, I think. Aesop said, "Gratitude is the sign of noble souls." Cicero, "Gratitude is not only the greatest of virtues, but the parent of all others." And Seneca, "Nothing is more honorable than a grateful heart." However, as we move closer to our own times, more and more cynical approaches have been taken to the notion of gratitude. For example, Edward Gibbon wrote, "Revenge is profitable, gratitude is expensive." Benjamin Disraeli, "I feel a very unusual sensation. If it isn't indigestion, I think it must be gratitude." And finally, H.L. Mencken, "In this world of sin and sorrow, there is always something to be thankful for. As for me, I rejoice that I am not a Republican." And finally, my favorite, Proust, "Let us be grateful for people." Bob, this is for you. "Let us be grateful for people who make us happy. They are the charming gardeners who make our souls blossom." Well, Bob, you and the writers and the editors and the staff of the New York Review of Books have not only made our souls blossom, you have made our minds blossom as well. You are, without doubt, the single greatest contributor to the intellectual life of the last half century that I know. You've done brilliant things with your colleagues at the New York Review of Books. It is our pleasure and our privilege and our honor to have you as a trustee of the New York Public Library and to have you moderating this discussion this evening. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a huge welcome to Robert Silvers.
Thank you so much for a great talk. Well, I want to, of course, thank Paul for that glowing statement. And I want to say that at the review, talking with our publisher, Ray Hedeman, and Catherine Tice, our associate publisher, we were having difficulty. Difficulty because we're trying to face the fact of being 45 years old. We wondered what we could possibly do about it. We dreaded going back to the thousands of reviews and articles in our archives, talking about our history, beginning when Jack Kennedy was in office, and going on to one hot and cold and cultural war after another. And so, we were particularly happy when my old friend and New York Review colleague, Jean Strauss, director of the Coleman Center for Scholars and Writers here at the library, and Paul Holdengraber, director of Live at the New York Public Library, suggested we have a forum here. And one great subject very evidently presented itself, the election campaign, and now the victory of Barack Obama and what it means. And I must say that I can't recall such a moment of exaltation and exultation since the end of World War II in my own life. So, all our thanks to Paul, the clerk, and our other friends at the Public Library for making this evening possible. And I also should mention the publication Metro, which is a supporter of Live at the New York Public Library. Now, our six panelists have all written over the years on American politics and culture for the Review, and several of them contributed to a special election issue that we published in October. I've asked them to consider two questions. First is, what do they think about the election campaign as we observed it in its ups and downs during the last year or so, and its outcome, the election of Barack Obama by 52.6% of the vote against McCain's 46.1%. With, to pluck out just one figure out of many, 66 of voters under 30 voting for Obama. And second, what do they think about the challenges that are facing him right now and after he takes office? They'll each speak for about 5 minutes. Then we'll be able to talk among ourselves, and then we'll address questions written on the cards you have. First, in order by alphabetical order, we have Andrew Del Banco, Director of American Studies at Columbia, author of books and essays on American history and culture, including his great biography of Herman Melville, and books on such themes as The American Dream and The Sense of Evil in the American Past. Time magazine called him America's best social critic. Joan Didion, a longtime contributor to the Review, her play, The Year of Magical Thinking, was performed on Broadway last season. She's one of the most acute observers I know of American political culture, whether in her novel Democracy, the report she's done for the review ranging from the war in El Salvador to one political convention after another, going back to the nomination of George Bush Sr. and Dan Quayle in New Orleans in 1988. She's one of the first writers to expose the hidden and pervasive power of Dick Cheney in her article, Cheney, The Fatal Touch, that we published several years ago. Now, she'll be followed by Jeff Madrick, a regular contributor on economic questions to the Review, editor of Challenge magazine, director of policy research at the Swartz Center at the New School, policy consultant for Senator Ted Kennedy, author of award-winning books, including one just published with the fortuitous title, The Case for Big Government. And he'll be followed by Michael Tomasky. By Darryl Pinkney, the member of the staff of the Review for years, contributor to it for decades. In 1992, he published his remarkable prize-winning novel, High Cotton, about growing up in America in the 1960s. He has for years been one of the most incisive critics of black writers and intellectuals in this country. And this year, he wrote revelatory essays for the Review on Barack Obama as he's been perceived within the black world and within the black church. And he will be followed by Michael Tomasky, the editor of Guardian America website, the Guardians from the Guardian of London. And he's the author of the books Left for Dead on progressive politics in America and Hillary's Turn about Hillary Clinton's election to the Senate. In recent months, his blog on the Guardian America website has been quoted again and again as one of the sharpest commentaries on the election. And finally, we'll hear from Gary Wills, one of America's most wide-ranging and respected writers, who's contributed a piece to our election issue on the dangers of the sweeping and intrusive executive power that emerged under Bush. He's a brilliant classicist, author of works on St. Augustine, studies of religious subjects. He's written some 35 books, including works on Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Lincoln, Kennedy, Nixon, Reagan, along with many commentaries on the Clintons and the Bushes in power. And so I don't see how we can void reflections on Barack Obama. And now our first speaker, Andrew Del Banco.
Can you all hear me with this? Okay. We've been told we have very strict rules, about 2.5 minutes on what happened and 2.5 minutes on what will happen. I'd rather take an hour on what happened because it's such a good subject, pleasant subject, and cede my time on what will happen because I more or less have no idea. But let me say one thing at the outset, a sort of narcissistic thing, which won't surprise those of you who know me. One thing that happened is that for the first time ever, I was right about a political prediction. I'm the guy, as my wife remembers, who was poll watching for George McGovern in the Central Square firehouse in Cambridge, Massachusetts, 1972, and came running home in great excitement to tell her that no one was voting for Nixon. It was the greatest upset in American history. And as I walked into the room, Cronkite was calling the election. So I've been wrong more or less every time since then, so it was very nice to be right for once. I think it was actually not a very tough prediction, given the approval ratings of the current president, the situation, especially in the economy that unfolded over the last few weeks. It would have been quite remarkable, I would think, if the Democrats had managed not to win this election. That might be a statement that not everyone agrees with, but seemed that way to me. Second thing that happened to me, and I'm sure to many of you, is that as we watched our retirement savings go into the toilet, We experienced a sort of dissociation of self because we were celebrating, right? The worse it got, the better it looked for Obama's chances. It would be nice if it came back now that the election is over. Now, enough about me, as it were. Senator Obama clearly, and there are people here who know much more about this than I do, but clearly ran a brilliant campaign. On the ground, as they say, harnessing the new technologies of communication, understanding the loosening of the evangelical vote in this country, the Hispanic vote in this country, did a remarkable job of surprising everyone except those who knew him and believed in him from the beginning. One interesting thing, at least interesting to me, is that he employed in the campaign a rhetoric of consensus that, in my experience at least, is normally reserved for afterwards. That is, the inauguration speech is typically begins with Jefferson, right? We are all Federalists, we are all Republicans. Even Nixon, in 1968, after he ran that nasty and cynical campaign, the Southern Strategy, exploiting racist feeling in this country and so on, even Nixon gave a rather good inauguration speech that year, saying, bring us together, that's what I was elected for. But Obama ran on that note and resisted a lot of advice, as far as I could tell, even perhaps from some in his inner circle, to fight back and to be more partisan and to show that he was a tough guy, which I suspect he is. Another thing that happened is that I think we've been so preoccupied, and properly so, with the extraordinary world historical significance of the fact that an African American was running and has been elected president of the United States, that we sort of missed the fact that we elected an intellectual, which one might make the case that that's almost as amazing in this putatively anti-intellectual country. We'll say, reserve that for later, maybe more could be said about that. Finally, as to what happened, everyone has a different way of saying it. We were all moved. We cried. I think it's not sentimental to have felt that way. I don't think it's a post-racial moment. We still have tremendous strides to make in terms of equity in this country, but it's an extraordinary moment. A lot of people have expressed it. I kind of like what Leon Wieseltier said in this week's New Republic. He said he decided to give away his tickets the next night for a Shostakovich concert because he wasn't in the mood for despair. Kind of a nice way to say it. As for what now, I'm really not being entirely frivolous when I say I have no idea. That's why I voted for the man, because I think he's smart and might be able to figure out what to do. I think he will have to, should, as the Republicans said he would, spread the wealth to some degree, that is, do some things to try to arrest the growing income gap in this country. That means pushing through Congress a more progressive tax structure, which would be hard to have it more regressive than we have now, make serious investments in education, which he has not said too much about. Most of what he said about higher education, for instance, has been about middle-class tax subsidies, which is fine, but doesn't really address the question of how many disadvantaged students in this country are foreclosed from education because their families can't afford to pay for it. I'm hoping he'll be aggressive. He has a sense of history. He's thinking about FDR's first 100 days, Lyndon Johnson's first 100 days. I suspect he will be aggressive and try to take advantage of this more or less mandate that he's won. How he'll do it, not sure. We'll talk about that some more, I'm sure. And then there is the matter of the rest of the world, getting us out of Iraq somehow in an honorable way without a conflagration following, coping with the situation in Afghanistan and doing something about the Israeli-Palestine question, which I suspect he'll be able to do, because this is a man who's capable of seeing merit on both sides of the question. Thanks.
Wait. Early in this in the primary season, which seems to have been with us for a long time, a certain number of us I have to say, myself included, began to feel an almost inexpressible uneasiness about the direction events were taking. What made this uneasiness hard to express was that it seemed to belie everything that we officially claim through election cycle after election cycle that we want. We were getting what we said we wanted, what we had always said we wanted. For the first time in the memory of most of us, a major political party was moving in the direction of nominating a demonstrably superior candidate, a genuinely literate man in a culture which does not prize literacy, an actually cosmopolitan man in an arena that deems tolerance of the world suspect by definition, a civil man, a politically adroit man. Enthusiasm was high, participation was up, yet something still troubled. What troubled had nothing to do with the candidate himself. It had to do instead with the reaction he evoked. Close to the heart of it was the way in which only the very young were decreed capable of truly appreciating the candidate. Again and again, perfectly sentient adults cited the clinching arguments made on the candidate's behalf by their children, by quite small children. Again and again, we were told that this was a generational thing we couldn't understand. In a flash, we were sent back to high school, and we couldn't sit with the popular kids. We didn't get it. The style section of the New York Times yesterday morning mentioned the Obama t-shirt that, quote, makes irony look old, unquote. Irony was now out. Naivete, translated into hope, was now in. Innocence, even when it looked like ignorance, was now prized. Partisanship could now be appropriately expressed by consumerism. I could not count the number of snapshots I got emailed showing people's babies in Obama gear. No, I couldn't count the number of times I heard the word transformational or inspirational. The whole of election night, I kind of kept dozing on and off, and the same people were always on television. And every time I woke up to them, they were saying transformational. I couldn't count how many times I heard the 60s evoked by people with no apparent memory that what drove the social revolution of the 60s was not babies in cute t-shirts, but the kind of resistance to that decade's war that, in the case of our current wars, unmotivated by a draft, we have yet to see. It became increasingly clear that we were gearing up for another close encounter with militant idealism, by which I mean the convenient redefinition of political or pragmatic questions as moral questions, which makes those questions seem easier to answer at a time when the nation is least prepared to afford easy answers. Some who were troubled in this way referred to those who remained untroubled by a code phrase. This phrase, which referred back to a previous encounter with militant idealism, the one that ended at the Jonestown encampment in Guyana in 1978, was, quote, drinking the Kool-Aid, unquote. No one ever suggested that the candidate himself was drinking the Kool-Aid. If there was any doubt about this, his initial appointments would lay them to rest. In fact, it seemed increasingly clear that he would not only that he would welcome healthy realism, but that his absence had become for him a source of worry. Quote, the exuberance of Tuesday night's victories, the New York Times reported on November 6th, was tempered by concern over the public's high expectations for a party in control of both Congress and the White House amid economic turmoil, two wars overseas, and a yawning budget gap. Quote, a headline in the same day's paper, quote, with victory at hand, Obama aides say task now is to temper expectations, unquote. Yet, the expectations got fueled. The spirit of a cargo cult was loose. I heard it said breathlessly on one channel that the United States, on the basis of having carried off its presidential election, now had, quote, the congratulations of all the nations. They want to be with us, another commentator said. Imagining in 2008 that all the world's people want to be with us may not be entirely different in kind from imagining in 2003 that we would be greeted with flowers when we invaded Iraq. But in the irony-free zone that the nation had chosen to become, this was not the preferred way of looking at it.
What struck me most about Obama over this campaign, in fact, is how much he changed, because events change remarkably, and I think our memories are short. I'm talking about the economy, of course, which is my area of greatest interest. I'm not talking about his character. Needless to say, I'm not talking about his pause. But when Obama started, I saw all three Democratic candidates, Clinton, Edwards, and Obama, make speeches a couple of summers ago. Obama was almost always talking about his biography, not about his policies. And an impressive biography it was. And the Clintons kept telling us he has no policy. He doesn't know policy, as did his other enemies. I do not know the truth of that, but he certainly didn't talk very much about it. As the economy, as Mrs. Clinton became more pressing, and as the economy became more pressing, Senator Obama rose to the occasion. And I think it tells us something about him. For my taste, he came up perhaps with too many policies to answer too many concerns. He was a little bit spread a mile wide and an inch thick. But he moved, and I think probably, and perhaps I'm reading into this, I think he learned a lot while he was on the job, which is no easy thing to do. Remember how remarkably times changed. The credit crisis was just at its early stages. Very few people could have predicted. In fact, nobody had predicted this devastation. Oil prices were just starting to take off and reach those ridiculous heights, and then started impeding consumer spending because consumers had no money. It became clearer. We started to lose jobs in the US beginning early in 2008, really in the end of 2007. And then it began to steamroll. Obama changed as economic events changed. He conveyed, I think, a sense of both authority and understanding that Senator McCain could not convey, partly because he had no interest, well known for, and sometimes I think even proud of having so little interest in the economy. That for me was what the campaign was about. What does it tell us about what may happen? Events are more severe now than they were at any time over this extraordinary period of the campaign, these extraordinary 2 years. Obama takes office when America is in a state of economic emergency, not merely crisis. Is it comparable to FDR? In some ways it is. Certainly it's comparable and perhaps more difficult than when Reagan took over, which was the other great crisis, the opposite, the mirror image of this crisis. Do we have a sense of what Obama will do? Well, I think we have a strong sense Obama will do, and a Democratic Congress will do a lot more than the alternative, had the other guys won. Will he? What we need now, I think, and I am certainly no outlier, we do need a very serious fiscal stimulus, because stemming the credit crisis is not enough. Making banks solvent, economic theory and economic history suggest to us strongly, making banks solvent will not be enough. They won't lend because their customers don't have business. It's since the Depression, this is an old saw of the progressives, in fact, and it seems to be coming true again. How much do we have to spend? Well, of course, now we face a big deficit. We've had a $700 billion bailout, very expensive. Conventional economists, economists at Goldman Sachs, economists at an investment firm called PIMCO, are talking about $300 to $500 billion over the next 14 months as economic stimulus to make sure this recession doesn't get worse. It doesn't get far more serious. It is going to get worse, but far more serious than it will. Will Obama rise to that occasion? It's quite an occasion to rise to. But I'm not going to answer that for a very good reason. I don't entirely know the answer to that. But I want to make one other thing clear in these opening remarks. The credit crisis, and even this recession, from my point of view, is not the biggest economic problem we face. We have neglected this economy and its assets and the foundation on which its future depends for 30 and 35 years now. In infrastructure, in education, in the lack of pre-K plans, in the almost criminal neglect of reform of healthcare, which will cost a very high proportion of GDP in coming years unless something is done about it. The to-do list, you call it a to-do list is to belittle it. It is very long. We have an emergency. The good news is we can get out of it. A stimulus plan, the good news is, can include the kinds of public investment we need that we've been neglecting in education, in broadband, in infrastructure, and so forth. That's the good news. Then we have to turn to the final, the tough part. I think, in any case, we have to raise taxes on the middle class, not just the well-off. We've got to pay for these new programs, and that'll be a big test down the road in the first term.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you mind if I use
this? No.
I need protection and distance. As well as sort of tremble behind the lectern is easier.
So, I am full of inappropriate friendliness to white people, and even suspect myself of being patronizing toward them. Yet I also can't believe Barack Obama's time has come, and I revisit on YouTube the countdown to victory in Grant Park, which we thousands watched on the big screen set up in front of the state office building on 125th Street. Interracial Harlem was jubilant, and the crowd sent up a roar of surprise and emotion at the pictures of the dancing in the street in Kenya. The emotion of so many on display in the streets around the world made me think of the night in November 1989 when the Berlin Wall went down. I'm not saying that Bush, Cheney, and the Republicans are like Honecker and the East German Communist Party, but the two events, November 1989 and November 2008, share the sense that an era has come to an end, that profound and sudden change has taken place, even that something has been overthrown. Germans wept that cold November night because they had at last overcome their history and were unified again as a people and a nation. The tears of Americans in balmy Harlem, understood by people around the world, said that it is not an impertinence to compare the outcome of our election night with the dramatic news that the Cold War was over. And while I am not saying that racism in America has come to an end, certainly white supremacy and the lawlessness associated with it have been repudiated. They have been made to depart from power. The election of Senator Obama to the presidency signals our return to a nation, the government of which respects law and order. As president, Obama could put an end to the technological banditry of missions over Syria and Afghanistan designed to target our enemies and then to take them out with missiles, as in the climactic scene of George Clooney's film Syriani. It has happened. The target turns out to have been a wedding, and U.S. officials denied that the casualties were civilian and then apologized for them, those casualties, once it was pretty clear that they had been civilian. A President Obama could renounce shock and awe, the short-sighted policy that resulted from the proposition that a war can be won without having to commit ground troops. He could also bring us back to the idea that the Geneva Convention is a good thing. President Obama will certainly save the Supreme Court and therefore the U.S. Constitution. The integrity of our institutions has been guaranteed, restored. I, like thousands, am bound for the mall this January because when I went to Washington to protest Bush's inauguration in 2000, the police prevented us from reaching that destination. The mall was chained off. We have accustomed ourselves to such a diminished public life that we are now scared that we are asking too much of Obama and are making too much of him. We need to be reassured, and so President Obama must keep talking. It is thrilling to think that his calm voice and his graceful manner were not just for the campaign, that as president he will go on talking to us like this. Overnight, public discourse has been elevated. How small and passé he makes, say, Sarkozy and Berlusconi seem. We are enthralled by his voice and his intelligence, by his literary gifts, his awareness of history, and a mystery about him that he is not likely to explore with us. After years of high-handed rule from Washington, we had become like those countries we tend to pity, where the state and the society have less and less to do with each other. The election of Obama has halted that deterioration. He has not only reconciled black and white, he has reconciled state and society. The Bush-Cheney administration was at war with reality, but the crowds at the inauguration will reiterate what Obama's decisive victory announced, that the American mainstream has been reconfigured, that we are a diversified nation, however mocked diversity is by the tough guys and the neocons. Many in Berlin never thought to see memorials to Holocaust victims around the city, something that was made more possible as the older generation, the defensive, guilty generation, began to die off. It was indeed awful to hear that the ban on same-sex marriage passed in California with 70% of the black and Latino vote. But President-elect Obama at Grant Park uttered the G word and acknowledged that gay people voted for him had been part of his coalition. Maybe the church victory of the ban will be short-lived. The visibility of gay people, the rise of the young who aren't bothered by this issue to positions of prominence, the whole new tone in the country may help to weaken resistance to gay men and lesbians achieving full rights as citizens. Time is on our side again, and maybe a great deal of the emotion that overtook us on 125th Street had to do with those who are no longer with us, those who did not live to see this moment. I voted with thoughts of the absent. And we are now back on the side of history. Signed, sealed, delivered, we're his. But who would wonder if President-elect Obama didn't know all about the misgivings men like Henry Adams or William Tecumseh Sherman had when Abraham Lincoln first arrived in Washington? People were desperate for direction. The air reeked of war, and the new president seemed so indecisive and quiet. Young men laughed nervously in the anteroom as the great soul entered upon its travail beyond the closed door. May the spirit of Lincoln continue to guide this unexpected and already trusted young man, black man, about to move his family into the White House.
Bravo.
Nicely done.
Well, the pressure's on. I'll revert to seated form, if that's okay. I was thinking on the train on my way up here today from Washington about Karl Rove. yeah, that's a laugh line. You will recall, I'm sure, many of you, in 2000 and 2004, that Karl Rove said he was helping to shape a new permanent majority, new permanent political majority in the United States. Well, it wasn't quite the one he had in mind, but wouldn't you know, he did. And I say that by way of this echoing some of Andrew's remarks. And I want to talk for a moment about what I think the impact of this election is politically, which is something that's being discussed quite a lot now in Washington. I start with the Rove anecdote because it is quite true, as Andrew said, that Republican failure and incompetence certainly did a lot to pave the way for this, let's face it. There's no question about it. This was, from Iraq to the failed Social Security privatization effort of 2005, which many people forget, but which is well worth remembering. This was the subject about which President Bush said, "I have political capital and I intend to use it." Those two matters, the then struggling, not yet in crisis, but certainly then struggling economy, and of course the fiasco of Katrina, which gave away the game, and at which point Bush's approval rating went down into the basement, a point at which I didn't think at that point it could have gone any further, but it has. People saw, average Americans saw, apolitical people who can vote for either party and don't pay that much attention to politics, saw at that point that conservative governance was failing them for the first time in a way that it hadn't really under Ronald Reagan, in a way it hadn't since the modern conservative movement started in the 1950s. This is what created the opening, and the opening was indeed wide and deep, but it took a very talented politician and a very, very disciplined campaign to exploit that opening. It was by no means to me automatic that a Democrat was going to win this election. Whatever the current president's approval rating, whatever partisan identification levels might be in polls, the fact is that when it comes to presidential elections, it's a 45-45 country. And, you know, I could be the Democratic candidate and Gary could be the Republican candidate, or the other way around if you prefer, and we'd both get 45% of the vote. Anyone could get 45% practically. We fight over the 10 in the middle. Obama won 8 of the 10, or 8.5. He did that through tremendous discipline and through the outreach efforts that you all know about and you've all read at great length about. If you have not gone to the New York Times website and looked at their national map where you can go look at county by county results, I urge you to. It's fascinating, it's a lot of fun, and you can look down into the lowest levels in Ohio and Indiana and Wisconsin and Iowa and other states and click on Madison County, Indiana, which I know nothing about, I confess, but it's in the middle of the state, and it doesn't have a city, and it seems like it ought to be a red county. And in 2004, it was indeed a red county by 20 points, 60-40. Obama won it by 5. And you can see this again and again and again as you look through these counties. Now, the scale of this change raises the question of whether this is a realignment election, as the political scientists like to say, along the lines of 1896, 1932, some would say, though not all would say, 1980. I think it still remains to be seen whether it is that. It does depend on what Obama and the congressional Democrats do with the power that they have, which brings me, and I'll conclude, to the question of what he may do as president. My one sentence version would be something like this, I suppose. I think he'll have very, very bold, progressive goals and ends. I think he'll pursue them in a deliberate and cautious fashion, because I think that's his nature. And I think he'll go quite slowly. And it may not be good enough for some people, and I will tell you now, prepare to be disappointed. You'll be disappointed once or twice. He'll move a little too slowly for some of us on some things, and I look forward to getting into a discussion about the size and extent of stimulus packages and so forth. but I think it's in his nature to tread slowly. But I also think this, for starters, I do think he'll obey the Constitution of the United States. Yes, that's an applause line. Yeah. For him, not for me. I think he will close Guantanamo Bay. I think he will bring the United States back within the Geneva Conventions. I think he will not order the intelligence agencies to cook their intelligence. And I think he will not fire United States attorneys for refusing to pursue baselessly political prosecutions. To start with, that's change I can believe in.
Well, there's no birthday party I would rather attend than that of the New York Review of Books. Who would have predicted, as this race began, that the final issues would be competence and steadiness? The Obama campaign ran sleek and silent as a Rolls Royce. The McCain people called that elitism, as they tried to make ignorance a credential for Sarah Palin. The McCain campaign ran in fits and starts like a sputtering jalopy, lurch after lurch after apparent targets of opportunity, Resco, lipstick on a pig, real Americans, Joe the plumber. The campaign was a tour de force of self-trivialization. McCain not only lost, but lost the one strongest thing he had going into it, his honor. He turned to the same thugs who had savaged him in 2000 with their Karl Rove tricks and distractions. He proved his loss of honor right now, by the way, by campaigning for Saxby Chambliss, the shameless man who calumniated Max Cleland. It is rightly said that the nation deserves congratulation for not letting race determine the outcome. But a less noticed aspect of it deserves attention, the passing away of the religious tyranny of recent election cycles. Not that McCain didn't want to use that, not only in cultivating the Reverend Falwell, but in saying at the very beginning of the campaign that the Constitution of the United States declares that we are a religious nation. That reminded me of what Andrew Carnegie said to Mark Twain. He said, whether you like it or not, Mark, you have to admit, this is a Christian country. And Twain said, well, I know that, Andrew, but so is hell. It's true, as Darrell says, that some states passed bans on gay marriage, but the presidential race was not thrown off track by things like sex education in kindergarten. The Republic appeal to evangelicals, Latinos, and Catholics was greatly weakened. Catholics by 52% and young Catholics at a higher rate ignored the bishops who ordered them not to vote for a pro-choice candidate. Only 45% had voted for their fellow Catholic, John Kerry. Latinos by 67% and young Latinos at a higher rate voted for Obama. 32% of evangelicals voted for Obama, as opposed to 16 for Kerry. I argued in a recent book that evangelical intrusions into politics have had a shrinking hold on the electorate over the long term. The Second Great Awakening had a strong run of about 30 years at the beginning of the 19th century. Fundamentalism had a strong but short run of 20 years at the beginning of the 20th century. The religious right has now had a shorter run of about 10 years at the turn of the 21st century. The best thing for the Democrats will be for them, for the Sarah Palin cultists, to keep her hopes alive, prolonging the losing religious fervor, beating, as it were, a dead moose. Her stands, anti-evolution, anti-stem cell research, humans palling around with dinosaurs, no abortion for rape or incest, will drive the religious extremists back to the margins where they came from. I don't have much time to talk about what's coming up, but I would like to throw out one thing that I think is important. I believe Afghanistan is a quagmire in waiting. We are no more going to create a government there and solve the drug culture than we did in Iraq. It made sense for Obama to say that Barack took his eye off the ball when he shifted from Afghanistan to Iraq. We had a great chance of catching bin Laden in the first thrust into Afghanistan. Now I think it would be a mistake to stay obsessed with bin Laden. Qualified people doubt that he is either alive or still relevant. Terrorism is a problem, of course, but it is a crime, not a country, and it has metastasized. The criminals should be sought with the help of all the intelligence and police and armed services of our allies. That's what we should have done at the outset. Maybe we can do it now. Thanks.
Well, I want to thank our terrific panel. I wonder if there's a question to be raised about the difficulties that Obama may encounter and the problems that he may have as a leader. Now, Jeff was saying that he will need to take really quite strong action, that he will have to have large expenditures that may require rise in taxes, for example. Now, Jeff, isn't it true that in many writings we've seen, Obama's tendencies in economic matters have been rather milder, have been, for example, he is supposed to be drawn to the views of Cass Sunstein and others about economic policy being based not so much on mandates, but on a kind of nudge, a kind of incentive that will persuade people, as opposed to rather larger imposed programs. The kind of program that you seem to suggest.
My reading of him is that he is. What I very much like about Obama is, I think, you remember when Jimmy Carter said he had no economic philosophy? That doesn't quite apply to Obama. I think he understands, he's a deeply intelligent man, it's quite impressive. And I think he understands economic points of view, economic ideology, and some might say theology. What I think he is drawn to is empiricism, facts, surveys. He wants to see what will work. One of the things that's appealing about this nudge book, which was really not Sunstein so much as Thaler, this Chicago economist who talks about behavioral economics, and if you just shift a little behavior a little bit, you can get better outcomes. I think he liked it because it was based on experimentation and empirical knowledge, not on ideology. But my guess is he's not going to stay there. For that same reason, he's got to begin to see nudge is not enough. And he's begin to see that we're sinking rapidly. When nudge came out, nothing like this was anticipated. And that we could go on about this, but unemployment is rising rapidly. And we're in very dangerous times. I think what I'm hopeful about most about Obama is this pragmatism of his, and that he's based in empirical facts, not an ideology. So will he go far enough? I'm not so sure, but I am hopeful that he will go as far as he has to when the facts are clear. Maybe it'll be slow. I'm not talking about the politics of it. But also his attraction to this Bartels book that everybody's talking about. Bartels book, one can disagree with it, but it's it's called Unequal Democracy, for those who don't know. It's really based on surveys on empirical facts and looking up the statistics, not in an ideology. And I really like that about Obama. I don't think he's stuck in a Chicago school ideology whatsoever.
It is the case that, for example, in the early parts of the campaign, Hillary Clinton had somewhat stronger positions on a number of economic issues than he did. For example, on injection of government funds to help in the housing question and the mortgage question. And that he, after September 15th, for example, changed his position in a more positive, more, you might say, more interventionist position. And that did emerge in the last 2 months.
I think he gradually became more interventionist as the economic conditions changed. Some of it was politics and catch up, I'm sure, with Hillary and so forth, but I think it's clear he reacts to the facts, and he's going to take office in a very difficult time.
Now, Michael, a lot of this will depend on going to be in charge of these bureaucracies, doesn't it?
Oh, true, sure.
And I wonder if you have some thoughts on that, because we have, we're in the dark, but we have a sense of contending possibilities, don't we?
If by thoughts you mean inside information, I'm afraid the answer is
no.
I'm just no. Look, I think that he will certainly he'll balance his cabinet in a way that will represent every wing of the Democratic Party, I think, which again will be disappointing to some people. But I do believe that that's what he'll do, and he will have Republicans and Independents, I think, in prominent positions, not just Transportation Secretary, which nobody really cares about, but in very prominent positions. He could have a Republican Secretary of State, for example. John Kerry seems to be the front runner at this point, but it's not impossible that Chuck Hagel, interesting, maybe he shouldn't be the front runner. It doesn't seem to me impossible that two Republicans, Chuck Hagel or Richard Lugar, could get that post, or possibly Dick Holbrooke could get that position. I think that he does believe in this post-partisan rhetoric that Andrew mentioned, and this is another reason why I think he will compromise at a point where some other Democratic presidents might not have. His healthcare plan was the least ambitious of the three major candidates' healthcare plans: him and Clinton and Edwards. And there was a political reason for that, but I think that it's an indication that he will, be a sort of cautious, and he'll try to cover as many bases as he can.
Well, one thing that I think we can go back to the campaign and ask about is what in the campaign, in its organization, in its ability to mobilize both modern communications and electronic communications and bring out crowds and get votes. What is new about that, and how may it translate into support of these programs that we're facing? Could the organization we've seen in the campaign be translated, conceivably, into a larger Democratic support publicly, nationally?
I think it can. People talk a lot about whether the Democrats are going to get 60 senators. It's an important question, but really, senators and members of Congress respond to their constituents, to what they hear from their constituents and what's below them. So if that same technology and method is used and millions of people are emailing their representatives, to get behind President Obama's this or that, then I think in that way that kind of technology can come into play, sure.
And do you have a clear sense? I remember in your article for the New York Review, you did put your finger on a number of elements that I don't think people quite appreciate, perhaps, about how he did operate.
With regard to the field operation?
I'm thinking of the use of the internet. Partly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I think, it's a story that's pretty well told, and I think many of you know it. But this apparatus that existed in the campaign, emailing people about when the vice presidential candidate is going to be named and that sort of thing, I think we have reason to think that it will continue to exist throughout the presidency.
Now, Andy, what were you about to comment?
Yeah. This line of questioning that began with your very good question, what kind of economic behavior can we expect? It seems to me, what we're really talking about here, we're trying to read the future by extrapolating from the past. We're trying to understand who this person is. And I think in some way we're still all trying to take the measure of the man. And it was not entirely wrong for his opponents, both within the Democratic Party and outside it, to say there's not much to go on in terms of a policy record. I think that the outpouring of support and excitement, some of it had to do with his symbolic significance. There's no gainsaying that, and I think there's nothing to be embarrassed about in that. But it had to do with his, it has to do with his personal qualities, with his eloquence, with his optimism. And so I'm not sure how profitable it is to try to look at what he's said or written, or how interventionist or passive he may be in the economic sphere. My own gut instinct is to look instead at what, where Darryl was leading us. I've always been struck from the beginning by how important Lincoln is to this man. And it's not window dressing, it's not gestural. He really understands Lincoln. He has read Lincoln through and through. He said at his first news conference that he's rereading Lincoln. I think that's true. And it connects for me with something that Jeff just said. You used the word empiricist. That strikes you as what. Now, when Darryl was talking about Lincoln in the early days of the war, you know, what came into my mind was this famous letter he wrote, I think it was to Albert Hodges, Gary will know, where he says much later in the war, when the people on the right are going after him that he's been much too aggressive on slavery, the people on the left are going after him that he's been much too slow, and he writes this letter and he says, I've never claimed to have controlled events. I confess plainly that events have controlled me. That, I think, is the keynote for me to Obama. This is a man who is responsive to the situation. And the situation has changed, as you suggested, very radically and very rapidly, and likely to change again while we're talking here tonight. It's an act of faith that we've committed our support to this man. We believe that he's got what it takes to respond to the changing situation. That's as far as I can go with it. He'll become interventionist and aggressive if that's what's called for, I hope and believe.
Now, Gary, you wrote in the New York Review an extraordinary comparison between Lincoln's Cooper Union speech after the John Brown crisis and Obama's speech in Philadelphia following the Jeremiah Wright episode. And you, I wonder what you feel about this analogy.
Yeah, it's interesting. The Obama people are afraid of the Lincoln comparison. They were criticized for starting his campaign in Springfield and said that he was comparing himself to Lincoln so much. So they didn't like that article too much. But what I've talked about was their ability to take a challenge, in Lincoln's case, John Brown, and in Obama's case, Jeremiah Wright, and not only blunt the attack, but rise from that to a longer view of history and the relations of the races and of slaves, in Lincoln's case. But if I could, I'd like to ask Jeff a question. You say that it will be almost necessary to tax the middle class, and I'll take your word for it. It may well be. But that makes me think of the first Bush. No new, read my lips, no new taxes. When he raised taxes, he shot his base right out from under him. Now, Obama has committed himself really far out on no taxes for the middle class. Can he survive if he raises them?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, my sense is the events are going to go his way. That doesn't mean he shouldn't raise taxes more on the better off. But I think, and needless to say, part of this is hope. People are going to recognize that when you pay taxes, you can support very useful social programs and public investment. Now, yeah, I realize I can be accused of wishful thinking here, but Bush was a long time ago. I have some confidence that people are going to recognize the uses of government again. You know, we've been imprisoned by an ideology, and that ideology of free markets and government is always evil. It's at best a necessary evil, as you've written about. I'm hopeful that will end, and I think what's incumbent the main step will be if he can begin to show that government can work and make a difference and begin to convince people. But I think we need more revenue in federal government and state and local governments to do what's necessary and has been neglected. And even if we do tax on average another 3% of GDP over time, we are still well below government spending proportions and tax rates in Europe and Scandinavia. And they do darn well. So I think there's a lot of room to move.
Hope so.
Well, now, Darrell, here you've been observed the history of black movement, a movement for racial justice, and now something new has happened. And I wonder how you see what's happened in relation to the efforts of movement for racial justice, for racial equality, historically. How you see Obama now?
I've seen some articles that want to say we've become post-racial, and that, of course, I don't think is true. I think that probably we'll speak more about class with race than we used to. It's always been a problem to speak about class in America as if it's unpatriotic. So I think there'll be more attention given to things that, say, William Julius Wilson used to talk about, you know, that in terms of what has to do with inequality, it's more a question of class than sort of race. But I sort of think that somehow it's not just symbolic, that Obama's election is a culmination of something that's been percolating for years. I think people actually wanted to vote for the black guy. And so I wanted to ask Joan, are you really so sure that our political culture isn't changing or isn't going to change?
Well, I think on that one issue, I think it changed tremendously. My own daughter was virtually colorblind. Now, that was a generation that grew up after certain things happened legally that changed, that actually you could see it change a generation. So yes, of course there's.
That's something that you've thought a lot about, this question of generations. Do you feel there's something that is detectable and in a very politically important way about how younger people see things when the influences they've absorbed?
Sure, it's very detectable in the numbers you cited when you were at the podium, and it's also, you know, it's also to some extent a very regional thing. You know, it's not as true, of course, in the South as it is in other parts of the country. The reason that in my short presentation I mentioned Wisconsin, Iowa, and Minnesota and Indiana and so forth is that there was far less in those states, and the results in those states and in New England, far less Obama faced far less of a hurdle in those states from white voters with incomes under $50,000 or white voters without college education. He didn't do particularly well in either of those categories, but in those central Midwestern states and the New England states, sadly, better than New York in Wisconsin, I have to say, better in Wisconsin than New York, I have to say, and better in Vermont, perhaps unsurprisingly. The regional disparity is quite stark, too.
Yeah.
I'd like to add something about that speech in Philadelphia. Newsweek, as you know, embeds people in campaigns that can't report during the campaign, but then they report afterward. And they gave the inside story of the gestation of that speech. His highest aides didn't want him to give that speech. Their tactic all along had been, don't bring up race. Let's say we're beyond race. Let's not dwell on it. It was Obama's determination to give that speech. And while campaigning full out for 3 days, in 3 nights he sat down and wrote the speech. So that tells us a good deal, it seems to me, about how he might be as president when he gets a notion that he's got the right path. He takes it, even though his advisors were against it. Not bad.
Yeah, I think
go ahead, Darren.
Oh, after you.
I think just quickly picking up on that point, I do not think everybody's worried about who his advisors are. And my sense of it is that he'll listen to his advisors, but he's not going to necessarily follow his advisors, more so than most other presidents. Yeah. And I'm pretty encouraged by that, if that's true.
That's Lincolnian, too.
Yes. Mm. No, I think he'll be a very kind of strong and almost too solitary figure in that regard. But very interested in how he will keep the interest of the young, having in some ways summoned them to politics and to civic duty. Will he create these kind of domestic peace corps and echoes of the Works Progress Administration? But the interesting moment will come when he decides, or in the debate over the draft. I was in the last draft, my number was very low. But now, these years later, I sort of think, had there been a draft, there would have been no Afghanistan, or no Iraq, rather, no Iraq. And so I sort of think that's maybe some form of national service should come back.
Andy, would that, what do you think about that?
Well, I just wanted to say, I mean, I think we're saying all the right things about the young, but we're not saying it quite loudly enough. It's a wonderful thing that this diminished public life that Darryl referred to has been enlarged, and especially for young people. I mean, we live, my wife and I live up at, in the Columbia neighborhood, and the sound of young people in the street celebrating when the election was called was a very beautiful sound. We haven't heard that in a while. And now there's a risk of disappointment, and I think some of what Joan was suggesting is there's a risk that there's a kind of almost incipient cultishness on the part of some admirers of Senator Obama, which I think he's sensitive to. But the fact that young people feel that the public life has meaning again is a wonderful thing, and I'm hopeful that he'll take advantage of it and be responsive to it in ways that will change his culture profoundly.
And that's not confined to America. In Chicago, there were people, young people, who came from France and England to volunteer and work in the campaign. That's astonishing.
It's sort of like he was elected president of the world. It's sort of, Well, but I think it may have a knock-on effect in terms of what other countries ask of their leaders, or should.
There may be a danger in getting carried away, and so I have a question that's just been submitted. What would your discussion be like if Obama had been defeated?
I wouldn't be here.
But you remember that in September, around the middle of September, that the polls showed that McCain was some points ahead. And a lot of people were quite worried about that. And then there was the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers. And the meltdown became a kind of a panic. And it's still a panic in many quarters. So, well,
I don't know what the panel would be like, but what he would be like as president, that Newsweek report that I'm talking about is very revealing. He blew up and was angry and shouting over the tiniest little things all through the campaign. They all walked around in fear of him. And among other things, they were all afraid they might be fired tomorrow. His unpredictability and his anger is such. He fought with his wife and she left the campaign for a while. And everybody was relieved because the tension went away. The man was totally unfit for the presidency.
Yeah, it was worrying. It's true. It's absolutely true. And I'm sorry. It was one of the most remarkable things. This thing kept happening during the campaign, that things that, let's say it, you know, people like us in this room perceive or know to be true, but we never think that a majority of Americans is going to agree, and they agreed. And it was just incredible. And this is one of the central things, that McCain temperamentally was unsuited to the presidency. He was the war hero. He was the older. He had 20-whatever years of experience in Washington. The knock of inexperience in Washington on Obama was, let's face it, rather legitimate in many ways, and so on and so forth. And yet, when crunch time came, their comportment compared to one another, to each other, made it clear that Obama was the guy who was ready to be president, and a majority of people actually agreed. It was astonishing.
We've been sitting here, said, Bob, talking about how we have to shore up the Democrats to stop McCain, the Democratic Congress. That's mostly what we'd be talking about, I think.
He had no grace under pressure. That was most interesting. The older man had no grace under pressure, and the younger man had extraordinary grace under pressure.
I think that's why, at the end, I wasn't so worried by people sort of saying, oh, Muslim, you know, sort of an N-word by other means, because it was sort of the impotent rage of the dying order. You know, you could sort of feel it. Well, and now I'm rather sort of interested that, you know, lots of white people kind of want to sort of, you know, check them out or say this or that and define it. And sort of, it kind of brings the discussion back where people had been afraid to talk about some sort of racial things before. Now they can. The one thing about Obama's speech in Philadelphia that I find remarkable is that he didn't say anything that most black people don't think. The fact that we thought it so remarkable only says how long it has been since someone said these things in a mainstream forum without these things being immediately attacked for being liberal or this or that. You know, the kind of a carping and sort of nye-nye-nye of the right has dropped away, yeah. You know, and it's a great relief. And I sort of look forward to all of them having the conversion experience and seeking new employment.
Your comment on the impotent rage of the defeated, Shakespeare said, the dying lion wounds the earth.
Well, we were talking about the dying lion, I do want to say one thing, which I think is will historically be of interest, that at some point last spring, we're told, McCain issued an instruction, which was that his campaign would make no use of the Jeremiah Wright issue. They wouldn't show the speech, the famous goddamn speech, on their campaign ads. They wouldn't raise the right issue in their propaganda. Now, it was clear that some people in the party and in the campaign didn't like that. One person didn't like it was Sarah Palin. She said, I don't know why we can't talk about it. I guess it's up to Senator McCain. She was obviously raring to go. That seems to be a decision that spared us a certain kind of exacerbated nastiness in this campaign. I wonder how it will be seen and how you see it.
Let me take a stab at that for a second. I agree with Gary that Senator McCain is unsuited to be president. But since I'm on a Lincoln kick, Obama also makes many, many times allusion to Lincoln's comment about the better angels of our nature. And my impression of McCain is that he's a divided guy. It seemed to me that he was off balance throughout most of the campaign because he was sort of at war with himself, and that he was at his best in the concession speech, which was very gracious.
But,
and it seemed to me he was almost relieved that he was conceding rather than taking the job. And I don't know the inside stuff about what was going on in the campaign, so I'm just guessing. But my guess is that, you know, it was the good angel in McCain that said, hands off Jeremiah Wright. It's low, it's ugly, leave it alone. And we should be grateful for that.
And one person who was involved in it said to me he didn't want to go down in history as the man who played the race card
openly.
Although he was willing to play the heirs card, Gary, was he not?
Yeah, it was a minimal decency. There's a lot of indecency. The idea that he really didn't want to win, maybe that explains Sarah Palin.
But many proxies went back to Wright at the end.
Yeah.
They didn't have, you know, the message at the end that this was with McCain's approval. But those ads ran in battleground states with Wright
continually
quite a bit at the end.
Yeah.
So,
particularly in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, it came out. Yeah. The fascinating thing is what happened to Wright. I think every black in Chicago went to him and told him, you can't be the guy who sinks us,
you know.
But he just disappeared.
On the other hand, McCain didn't do anything to stop the other people.
No.
Right. And contrast the reaction of McCain and Palin to crowds shouting hateful things, and Obama instantly silencing them. We don't need booze, we need votes. He handled that just perfectly.
Yeah.
Here's a question for Joan. although you separated the president-elect from the gushing naivete of his base, does it worry you that such a relatively young man is being praised with such fervor? What would your advice to him be to not buy into his own press?
Well, I don't think he does, actually. I mean, I think that so far he is, I think you could see increasingly kind of throughout the campaign, he would back away from that kind of unmodulated response to him. What he will do now, I would think it would be in a lot of ways easier to do in the presidency, where you have real things to do rather than campaigning, than it is during a campaign when all you have to, when what you're doing is selling a version of yourself, and it would be very seductive, I would think, to someone campaigning, if there was this wonderful version of yourself out there that everybody was ready to buy. It would be very seductive not to buy it, and he resisted that.
When he went back to his headquarters in Chicago, when he would go in to rally the troops, he would say, "I'm not a perfect candidate. I've got to do better, and you've got to do better, and you've got to carry me." Now, that's
good.
That's not drinking the Kool-Aid. He's not quite George Washington. Washington, on the night of his inauguration, after he had been deified, wrote in his diary, "This can all vanish in a minute."
Oh.
Well, I'm counting on Michelle, actually, to keep that in check. I think so is he.
Yeah.
Well, here's a question that Gary and others, no doubt, will have some views on. The question is, well, what happens next to the right in America? Do you think Christian conservatives will react now? Will they mobilize? Will they grow more powerful? Or will they return to a candidate more like Goldwater?
Well, Goldwater was never the religious right. The most viral side of the right is religious now, and they're fanatics, so they'll keep at it. But I think that they will divide the party. The moderates disappeared or acquiesced or were intimidated by the religious right. But now I don't think that's going to be true at all. They're going to lose there. That's why I say, if Palin is promoted, I think that's all for the good.
Well, it turned out the religious right didn't work for them this time. They couldn't use the religious right.
Yeah.
Why, I'm not sure. Why do you think?
Well, they were very enthusiastic. They were enthusiastic at the very end when Palin
but
they weren't for McCain. They've never liked McCain.
But they usually stayed on, until now they've stayed on board.
Yeah. No, they were lukewarm until she came along, and then they really fired up.
I never got into the Palin thing. I never watched it. I never watched the Katie Couric or Saturday Night Live. I so disliked the way she wore that baby like a brooch.
Oh, exactly. You and my wife.
Yes, Andy.
On this question of the future of the Republican Party, I stuck my neck out in the review, and on the basis of very little evidence, suggested that I thought evangelicalism was changing in this country, and particularly younger evangelicals. I read an article that I found interesting that the number of black students at evangelical colleges was going up, and that evangelicals were thinking about the environment a lot more than they once did. What's your sense of that? I mean, I think the Republicans have a big problem with adjusting to that.
I think that's true. After all, 32% of evangelicals voted for Obama. So clearly they are changing, especially the young. But the old guard is still around and still bitter, and they're the ones who are in the Palin camp, the anti-evolutionary, anti-abortion, of course.
let me just remind everyone that if the Republican Party turns away from cultural conservatism and the religious right, which I'm not sure they'll do, but if they do, in many ways, their most plausible candidate in 2012 is a certain former mayor of this city.
You don't mean Giuliani.
Yeah.
Giuliani is so over. No. No. I think they'll get that Indian governor of Louisiana because everything in America goes by precedent, and so now they'll try to find another brown person.
Right. my wife and I had dinner in Williamsburg last March, February, with some Democratic congressmen. Rahm Emanuel got us together. And my wife sat across from Charlie Rangel. And she said, "Do you think Giuliani will be the candidate?" And he said, "We're ready."
Well, here's one of those rather unfair questions, but still worth at least putting, that to each panelist, don't have to do it. What should President Obama's first executive order be? And what do you expect his first executive order will be?
Could be multiple. It could be withdrawing a number of executive orders together. That's what some people are suggesting.
Canceling a number of Bush.
On regulation, on abortion, on the environment, on drilling in Utah. They're all up. In a way, there's no reason to prefer one to another. What I most want him to do is stop signing statements. That's nullification. That's executive defiance of the law. George Bush II signed more signing statements than all the presidents preceding him. On one bill, he had 32 constitutional objections to a single bill. David Addington wrote those at Cheney's request. And for instance, you know, McCain fought to get the torture law through, and Bush just did a signing statement that consigned it to irrelevancy.
And then it is the case that I think that McCain did betray that commitment by saying voting against the banning of coercive interrogation.
Yep.
So that was a very low point, I feel, in the campaign.
Michael mentioned the closing of Guantanamo. I would think that as a statement to the world, a move in that direction at least would be a very powerful one.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and they're working on it. It's not just a fanciful notion. They're actually working on it. I think the lifting of the global gag rule on abortion will probably be the first or among the first executive orders that he'll make.
Well, we have some other questions. Jeff, what do you think about the automobile companies? Should they be rescued, or should this be a major and primary goal? Or
I was afraid somebody would ask that.
What's that?
He was afraid.
That's a pretty tough. You know, a lot of people work for auto companies. They owe a lot of pension money. A lot of people depend not only on their current jobs but on their retirements and their health care. It's very hard for me to think we should be letting these auto companies go. For that reason, also I think that they've suffered unfairly from a high dollar and so forth. I do not think they've been managed very well. I think they probably have to be cut in size. So no, I don't think they can be let go, but perhaps a merger could be encouraged with government money. I don't think it should be a lot of government money if it can be helped. And it's got to be thought through in coordinated effort between the government and the auto companies to think about what is possible and what can endure. not obvious that three companies can endure in America. So what can we save is the issue.
If the rationale were environmental, if the money was given only on condition that they start creating fuel efficient and alternate energy, I think that would cause jobs, and it would also improve the environment, and it would also give him a cover.
I think there's a give and take on that. It would cost jobs because, you know, it adds cost to production, and a lot of lines would go out. I generally favor that idea, but it doesn't come without costs. And it has to be analyzed pretty seriously.
The first bill he proposed as senator was exactly this, was tied the greening of the auto industry to certain guarantees for automakers about pensions and so forth. So I would assume that he's still interested in that.
Well, we're coming to the end, and there is one question that is being posed here, and several questions, and that is, should we not be deeply concerned about what may be a black hole in Afghanistan? And I must say that in talking to experts that I know, they do ask how any reasonably predictable number of troops could cope with the porous border, the domination of warlords financed by drugs, and the reluctance of our NATO allies to get deeply involved at the same time.
That's why I called it a quagmire in waiting. I think it would be a terrible mistake to commit ourselves to an all-out effort to reshape that country. We would be pouring resources out the same way we did in Iraq.
I would vote with Gary on that. I'm very concerned about the state of the economy, as I've made pretty clear, but if I were to pick my biggest concern, it would be these statements Obama's made about Afghanistan and words like winning. I think we need a way to rethink this entirely.
Well, I want to say that we've sounded some very enthusiastic notes, and I think it's right, given the New York Review way of doing things, to end on a cautionary note. And so I want to thank our panelists, and thank you.